Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me on the other side of this conversation is James, not Spader. Before we get started, I want to get you to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've done a whole bunch of content in the last month or so. We did a podcast about Neighbors. We most recently did a podcast about X-Men Days of Future Past and Boogie Nights before that, and Mean Girls before that. So yeah, check those out at themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen, and follow us on iTunes. Give us a yeah, I know,
iTunes.
got super Canadian at the end there. It was a crawl show sketch that just came out of me. But the yeah, give us a 5-star rating if you like on iTunes. Subscribe to us. Tell your friends. Tell people that aren't your friends. Tell random people on the street that seem like they might be interested in podcasts. Anyway, let's get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
This is the part where you asked me what we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. I'm not gonna do it, but that was a gruel situation, all right? I was thinking of a bunch of things.
We are talking about the 1989 movie,
mm-hmm.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Okay.
All lowercase.
Yeah.
No commas.
No. Wait, I thought there were commas. I thought there were two commas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's no ampersand.
Okay.
They spell the word. Okay, now that we've talked about the important part of this film, written and directed by Steven Soderbergh.
Okay, I didn't hear you say that the first time.
Okay, written and directed by Steven Soderbergh and starring four people, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A very indie movie.
Yeah.
Is a way to put it. You know, a small movie, small cast, like six speaking parts, four characters that seem to actually matter.
Mm-hmm. Very, are we not
you know,
counting Barfly?
That's one of them, yeah.
Oh, okay. So Andie MacDowell doesn't count?
Yeah, she's out. No, but very, you know, kind of what you think of when, or at least kind of what I think of when I think of an indie movie, just kind of character-based, a quiet, lots of dialogue, not a lot of action. You know, it's not a fun movie. It's not a action-packed, hilarious movie, but I think it's a very good movie.
Okay.
You don't?
I see its appeal. I'm sure, I know this is a thing I say semi-frequently, but, you know, if I saw it in 1989, I'm sure I would have loved it, but watching it now is just like, it's interesting as a, like, piece of history to me. And it's very interesting that way. So it's kind of interesting as this piece of history. Like, it's certainly an important film, but like as far as actually watching it, I'm just not that crazy about it, you know. Like I enjoyed it. I definitely enjoyed it, and but I just kind of felt like the way I feel about a lot of Soderbergh things. Like, I see why this idea is interesting to him, and I'm a big fan of Steven Soderbergh in general, but a lot of the things that I think made it a good movie at the time just kind of don't work for me 25 years later. You know?
Okay, like what?
Well, I mean, there's just so much. Like, I just remember the ending just killing me. Like when they're just sitting down, Andie MacDowell says, "I think it's going to rain," and then I was like, I said out loud, it is raining. Like, I hadn't seen this movie before we did this podcast. I said out loud, it is raining, just as James Spader's about to say it. And then I'm like, cut to black. And that's what happens in the movie. And it's just kind of that type of thing that we know all of the beats to this type of movie now. So it's kind of hard to be interested in such a trailblazer. There are certainly lots of interesting moments. I think the conversation between the videotaped conversation between Anne and Graham, I think is my favorite part of the movie for sure. I think James Spader is great in this movie.
He's really good in this movie.
Yeah. In such a weird way. But yeah, and I think that his conversation with Anne is really good, and also Peter's, or sorry, John Mulaney's reaction to it. Yeah, I think basically the last half hour of the movie I like, save for parts, but there's just a lot of stuff like the quiet loner with the black shirt sitting across from the lawyer and the suit and the white shirt, and just the way they're framed, like the black and the white, like it's just, there's a lot of stuff like that. Yeah. And like, I'm worried about the garbage at the beginning. That was a real eye roll. And probably something that would have been really interesting in 1989. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, you say you, you enjoy it sort of as a piece of history. Can you just talk a bit about what you mean by that and this movie's place in history, and then maybe we'll talk a bit more about the movie itself? Just kind of contextualize this movie's release a little bit and its legacy?
Yeah, well, let's do the legacy after we talk about the movie. But to contextualize it, this movie...
1989.
Yeah, it's kind of the first financially successful, like really financially successful independent movie. Like it's a big turning point for Miramax specifically, because they figured out a way to market it, you know, talk about the sex a lot in marketing, which is something that Miramax, or sorry, the Weinstein Company still does. If you look at the most recent poster for Sin City, that the new Sin City movie, that's a good example of it. And it was kind of the first movie with this independent sensibility, a movie that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, to really make a dent with commercially. And I mean, it's not like it set the world on, it wasn't Avatar, but it made money in a way that hadn't been done in independent film before, and sort of almost legitimized Sundance. It was a big deal at Sundance as well. Did a lot of good things for that festival. And yeah, it was just kind of there had been a building up of independent film in the 80s. Like, people talked about Jim Jarmusch, but not the normal, or not the average person, just kind of like film critics. And Spike Lee was on his way up. 1989 is the same year as Do the Right Thing, which isn't an independent film, but Spike Lee always has those kinds of feels to his movies sometimes. But yeah, it was just kind of the first legitimately independent movie to make a dent to normal people in any way.
Right. Yeah. And you know, a few things. It cost $1 million to make. It made $25 million, and that's, you know, $25 million in 1989. Again, as you said, it's not Avatar. It's not like this was, you know, shattering records or anything. But for a director that pretty much no one knew, Steven Soderbergh at this time.
Well, yeah, it's his first movie.
Yeah. And Miramax, as you brought up, an independent film studio, had been around for, you know, about 10 years at this point. They just hadn't really, you know, made a big splash of this.
Yeah, they're
and
most...
So a big release for a pretty small studio. And, you know, a lot of people know Miramax now. And obviously they went on to distribute a lot of very notable, you know, indie filmmakers, or kind of, as you said, with Spike Lee, independent-minded, or people who have that feel, went on to distribute a lot of their movies. And now it's a studio that, you know, anyone who likes movies would recognize.
Yeah, they're the Weinstein Company now, but yeah, they were at arm's length as a studio, like by themselves by like 2002. You know, they were producing Cold Mountain and The Gangs of New York, both very high budget films. You know,
yeah. And in the meantime, they, you know, Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith, Woody Allen, a lot of these big directors. You know, directors, people know the name of directors that have a certain feel to them, and I guess, you know, are able to make movies the way that they want to. And yeah, so this was kind of Miramax. I guess they released My Left Foot later that year, later in 89, which was another success.
Yeah.
But yeah, for Soderbergh and Miramax, the studio, this was just kind of the a really, really big jumping off point for both of them.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, Miramax doesn't have anything to do with the actual film production. They just distributed it. I mean, pretty much all of Miramax's big successes, and Actually, I mean, because Gangs of New York didn't make a lot of money. Pretty much all of their biggest successes are things that they picked up for distribution or scripts that they picked up and turn around. You know, they never really fostered a great idea that turned into a great movie. They just sort of were able to recognize gold when they saw it. That was kind of the Weinstein thing.
Right. And then here we have them, as you said, you know, just marketing this properly. And, you know, this did well, you know, around the world. So, yeah, it was just a big kind of jumping off point. Same for Andy McDowell, too.
Yeah.
She didn't have much of a career before this.
Well, yeah, she was kind of in movie jail for the whole Tarzan thing. Like, all of her lines were overdubbed by Glenn Close. She had a very small part in St. Elmo's Fire. But yeah, I don't think there's much of note between that and this. She was in movie jail of sorts, you know. And it kind of like this really, this because of that type of thing where if you're having trouble being interesting in Hollywood, try and make an independent film. Like James Spader kind of set himself apart from the image of the guy he plays in Pretty in Pink that he plays so well, but he's a totally different kind of character as Graham. And it really set the tone for how actors would figure out how to be interesting, and they would just go to independent film.
Yeah. Right. And, yeah, so I guess let's talk about James Spader a little bit. As you said, up until this point, he was always just the preppy douchebag. and now this one, he's, you know, the dark, mysterious, kind of, you know, damaged, but brilliant character, I guess.
Is he brilliant? I don't know.
It's
not like I don't think he's dumb. I just don't know that.
Yeah, maybe brilliant is not the right word, but you know, he's damaged, but still supposed to be seen as a very good person. Right. I think in this.
Well, yeah, I think he's the guy we're supposed to most identify with. I think. Or yeah. Anne, but Anne's just so. I don't know.
So what?
Her hair is impossible. Nobody can have that hair. How can you identify with it?
Well, you brought up that opening scene already of her in the with the therapist talking about all the trash or the family of airline crash victims.
Yeah, and how happiness is overrated. Last time she was happy, she got fat.
Yeah. Wow, you really sound like you hate this movie.
I don't hate this movie. I just don't. I mean, I just don't like it that much. Like, you know, as I was watching, I was like, yes, this is interesting. I see its appeal. There was nothing that made me go like, wow, you know.
Not even James Spader?
James Spader's very good, but also in a way that happens to kind of be accidentally funny sometimes. So he doesn't quite stay on the line that he needs to stay on with his whisper talking and his iced tea. But there's so much iced tea in this movie. It is rampant. But yeah, no, I do think he's quite good in this movie. But yeah, I don't know. There's just always something going on that I'm not crazy about.
Okay. Anne's character entirely you dislike, or just kind of some of the dialogue like that?
No, not entirely. It's just, I don't know. It's kind of hard to describe. It's just the feel of the movie. It feels old now. Like, it just feels like an old movie that is interesting for history purposes. Like, I feel like the way, like if a 10 or 15 year old watched Animal House now, you know, it's probably not going to seem very funny. Like, you're not going to be able to see the parts that were a big deal in 1978 or whenever that movie came out. And this is kind of how I feel, just because it was such a big movie. And really, I don't know. It's like watching a cookie cutter be made is kind of how parts of this movie feel. Like the really intense cleaning of the house that Anne does, you know, she's cleaning with such vigor. She's trying to fix her life.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know, it's just such a big metaphor.
Well, yeah, the trash bin that she talks about, your favorite scene up there, the trash bin that makes trash.
One of my favorite moments in this movie actually does happen right at the beginning. Because, I mean, we open with a shot of a car rolling over the road, like we're getting it from the car's point of view looking down. When that car kind of, and it, you know, it ends up being Graham's car, as he like stops and then reverses like to park at the bait shop or whatever that place actually is. I thought that shot was awesome. And I was like, oh, this is great. You know, Soderbergh was around back then, you know, because that's such a Soderbergh-ian thing to do.
Yeah. Okay. What about Cynthia? Is this kind of, and John too, are these kind of too much of a caricature for you? Like, are these really underwritten characters? Is John just the bad husband/lawyer? Like, of course he's a fucking lawyer, right? And Cynthia, like, is she just sex? Is there anything more to that character?
I think there's more to Cynthia than John, but I don't think by much. I think, like, none of them bother me. I think I care more about Cynthia in the most mild fashion. I care slightly more about her just because, John really is written as this. I don't think he says one interesting thing throughout the movie. He's just like just a list of cliches, like him talking about how a wedding, like women hit on you so much more now that you have a wedding ring and that type of thing. Like, if only I had Super Bowl tickets for every time that happened.
He has to be a football dude.
It's just like pretty much everything he says in the movie is just so.
He makes fun of the wife's cooking. Like,
oh, the salt.
what a bad one.
Like, wow, yeah. It was harsh. He's just really unlikable.
I like him spinning his wedding ring around on the table. I wish it wasn't hammered home so hard with all the comments about how he could be cheating and how many women hit on him now that he is married.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's would be a cool little visual thing if it wasn't really heavy-handed with the dialogue.
Yeah, that's fair.
I enjoy that part a little bit.
But we don't know that he's actually cheating at the time.
No, I guess rewatching it, I already did know that. So, that's a little thing that I like. And, you know, maybe, as you said, maybe if this, because it's 1989 and it's, you know, kind of a trailblazer and now so many things are like it that they can be a bit less... be a bit more subtle about it.
Yeah.
Maybe they could have done that a bit more subtly, with a bit more subtlety now than kind of the ham-fisted way I'm describing them doing it in this one.
Yeah, for sure. I would say Cynthia's more interesting a little bit, but just because I think she just has better lines, you know, like, and she's just kind of more of a... And she does more unexpected things, I guess. She always seems like you can't necessarily predict what she's going to do. You know?
Yeah. And
Peter, the most interesting thing about John's character is just that thinking about what he used to be like, you know, that's the interesting aspect of John, is trying to figure out what him and Graham were like 9 years ago when they were friends.
Yeah. Yeah, Cynthia at least has some ambivalence to her character. You know, she's obviously not a good sister and a good person for cheating with John or having John cheat with her, I guess.
She does wear a literal black hat at one point.
That's true. Yeah. But I mean, at least she, you know, she's disgusted with him at one phone conversation, you know, when she hangs up on him and says, you know, she doesn't want to have sex this time, or... when he's at her house and, you know, she makes it clear nothing physical is going to happen because, you know, she seems upset with him. It seems, you know, as many bad things as she does, there are moments of guilt, or once in a while she does kind of step back and look at what she's doing and even momentarily be disgusted with him and by extension herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not just... the opposite of Anne, I guess. You know, Anne's supposed to be sexless and, you know, cold, whereas Cynthia is, you know, more fun and obviously much more sexualized. But we do kind of see moments of, you know, a genuine good person in Cynthia. And, you know, we can see how Anne and Cynthia are sisters at one point and not just negatives or opposites of each other.
Yeah.
Not a lot of sympathy for her, though.
I don't know. I don't think I'm very frequently particularly sympathetic with characters in movies. Yeah. I mean, sympathy is something I don't feel too frequently in my real life. So when we add that to film, I just think it's gone entirely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Graham.
Yeah.
Interesting character.
Yeah.
Uses the bathroom twice in 2 minutes.
So weird. When he's like, false alarm. Oh, I'm ready to use the bathroom now. That's so weird.
That I wouldn't say that to someone I've known my whole life, and he just met this woman. Like, I just wouldn't say that. And he's immediately comfortable enough to be like, no, you know that feeling you get in your genitals when you think you have to pee? You don't. Just happened. Oh, you know what? I'm ready now.
Yeah. You know, it's been 2 minutes. I'm ready to
go. False alarm. So weird. Yeah.
And the way he just like hands strawberries to her as he's on his way to the washroom is so weird to me too. Yeah,
no, his whole entrance is a very odd exchange. Yeah. And I guess it's because she comes around to him. Like, I guess he doesn't. She's, you know, we get the idea that she's apprehensive about him staying there at all because of what she tells the therapist. So because John didn't even ask her if he could stay. She's obviously a little standoffish towards him, but
yeah. And we know he, because we hear him say it later, he felt a little weird about being invited because he felt like, even though he was invited, it wasn't really his place to be there. So there, right. You kind of got similar versions of different versions of the same feeling operating on both sides of the conversation there too, right?
Yeah, and as the movie goes on, we learn that Graham and Anne are kind of more similar than they appear at the beginning.
Yeah.
But yes, I hope you like this brown bag of strawberries.
Well, she does seem to eat some of the dessert, which is strawberries, so.
Yeah.
She's certainly not entirely against the idea of strawberries.
So is it... what's kind of the turning point here? Is it his lack of sexuality makes him harmless, so Anne trusts him more immediately?
What do you mean? What do you mean? Like, turning point for what?
For kind of Graham and Anne getting along at all. And
I still don't understand why they get along. I think they're both just... I think initially it's that they just both don't have anything to do. I think that's what it is. I think it's kind of that whole, once you get to a certain age, you just, any opportunity to make a new friend, it comes by so rarely that you're just kind of, well, let's see what happens. Let's go for a drink in the middle of the day because we can both go for a drink in the middle of the day. And yeah, I mean, removed from the workplace, you know, once you're past 29 or something, it's really difficult to make friends. You know?
Yeah. And since she doesn't have a job and he has a mattress that prints money, they're allowed to just get wine drunk at 1 p.m. Yeah.
He does seem to just be drinking iced tea, but we don't know that it's spiked. He has iced tea and water in case the sugar gets a little too real for him.
Yes, but back to my question. They both seem to... take his impotence as like an invitation to develop a real relationship, like a real connection.
Well, yeah, it's just kind of that
is it like finding out he's gay, essentially?
No, I don't know. I think it's just kind of like finding out, I think that's kind of, that's a dedication to wanting to make a friend, is telling somebody, or, you know, asking the question, what's something you're embarrassed about? And then actually answering that, I think that that's kind of a dedication to just being like, oh, we barely know each other, but like, I'm willing to try and get to know you quite a bit. It's just, I think it's just kind of a conversational, I mean, desperation is a bit strong of a word, but a bit of a desperation tactic, you know, just because if we start talking about weird shit, we're going to stuff to talk about. It might go way off the rails if I totally read you wrong, but at least then we'll know not to waste our time with each other anymore. Yeah,
right.
So, yeah, and that does start the friendship for sure, just because, I mean, once somebody knows something weird about you, you know, if you're a normal person, you're more inclined to keep them close to you, you know, just because they know something that you probably don't want a lot of other people to know.
Right. But I guess with me, that certainly seems to help with Anne. And that makes sense to me because Anne, as we learned in, you know, the first scene of this movie, is not a very sexual person, or at least not in this time in her life.
Yeah.
And so her finding someone like Graham, who, you know, not that he doesn't care about sex, he clearly is very passionate about the subject, to go so far as to document people's feelings about it, but can't act on it. Mm-hmm. I can see why that works for Anne and Graham getting along. Why does it seem, what's the genesis of his relationship with Cynthia then?
Well,
her impetus seems to be spite at first. Well, like, yeah. her sister has something that she doesn't have, so she has to go out of her way to get it.
There is a lot of spite with Cynthia, like, because it seems like Anne was always the good kid. You know, she probably always got better grades and stuff like that, you know? And
has the husband in the house. And
yeah, exactly. She's got a more traditional happy life, from the outside at least.
She can't be happy because she's not fat, right?
That is a good point. there is a real sibling rivalry there. I mean, that's part of the reason why she's fucking her husband, for sure. And also, yeah, she just, it's part of the wild card aspect of Cynthia's character. She just kind of wants to meet Graham, and there doesn't seem to be that much more of an explanation given for the movie. The most explanation I can come up with is just that she just doesn't want, Anne to be in on this new interesting thing and her to be left out in the cold. Yeah.
Do you think that maybe Cynthia doesn't like sex as much as we're kind of led to believe, and that she kind of sees someone like Graham as a chance to have a relationship that it's never going to devolve into just having sex?
Does she know he's impotent? Does that get talked about?
Actually, I don't know. That's true.
Yeah, I don't think she does. Maybe she just wants to date somebody, and having her sister say, hey, he's okay, is kind of a good head start. You know?
That's good enough, yeah. Okay.
And he looks like James Spader, so he's not unattractive. You know? He's got weird eyes, but most people find him good looking.
Does he have weird eyes?
He's got, like, kind of bug eyes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What about, what do you make of Graham's relationship, I guess, with Elizabeth? And, you know, what we eventually learn about that? Are you surprised we don't see Elizabeth? And kind of how much of Graham's character is explained by what did or didn't happen with this relationship like 9 years ago?
I'm not surprised we don't see her. I think it's more interesting that we don't, because the movie is, or a lot of Graham's elements in the movie are about keeping people at arm's length, having them tell him very interesting things about themselves through a screen. I think keeping Elizabeth at arm's length is much more interesting because it helps him to continue to idealize her, even though we find out she did cheat on him while they were still dating, and also gives him an excuse to continue to sort of, again, wallow might be a bit of a strong word, but to sort of just sit and think about his past without ever actually having to engage in it. Yeah. You know?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I still kind of struggle with, Graham's character. Not that I think it's, you know, poorly written or anything, but just all of his motivation. And so do you think he, you know, has people talk about themselves just to avoid thinking about himself or having to speak on his own.
Definitely. I think that's what Graham's all about, is avoiding his own feelings by being interested in others.
Then why is he so willing to offer up something like impotence, which you would think would be something anyone would want to hide, especially someone who doesn't want to reveal things about themselves? It seems so intimate.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's just kind of, I don't know, he's out of his element. He's away from his protection, you know. I don't have a good answer for that. I'm just trying to come up with one. But that's the best I got, you know. It's just, he is at the core a person that likes sharing. And, you know, when he's in an interview setup, it's more okay for him to protect himself by just the setup of the situation. You know what I mean? He is inclined to talk about himself, and he just likes to create a situation where the focus is on you talking instead.
Yeah, because he does seem to be...
Because he doesn't trust himself, basically.
Yeah, he offers up some stuff in those interviews. I think of the moment when he's sitting on the couch. He's sitting on the chair, and Cynthia's on the couch. I think it's the one of Cynthia. Yeah, it's the one of Cynthia. And it kind of reminds me of the beginning of the movie where we have the therapist in the chair and we have Anne on the couch. You know what you know what I mean by this comparison?
Yep.
Okay. And so
he's lying on the floor during Cynthia's interview, I believe.
No, this is what I mean. He starts on the chair, similar to the therapist. But then he very quickly moves onto the floor, and not even just sitting on the floor, but lying down on the floor, which is, lying down is the classic psychiatrist patient position, right? Mm-hmm. And so he kind of sets it up as though he's the therapist. So the one in control, the one with all the knowledge, the one with the authority. But then very quickly gives it away and, you know, lies down, and whereas Cynthia's still sitting, lies down on the ground even below her, kind of giving off a vibe of subservience to being, you know, giving up that power of authority very quickly. He seems to get in this interview setting, and I hadn't really considered it, but I think it's like you said, he wants to talk about himself. He's not very willing to write off in a normal conversation, but once he gets this interview thing set up, which is, you know, exactly what he wants, he does start engaging with his own personal life a lot more easily. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to grapple with that, of why this interview setup is some place that he's willing to share anything about himself.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't. You know, like I can't give you a good answer, but yeah, I don't know. And even like by lying down, he the fact that he is physically lower than Cynthia even just sort of puts her in the position of power. Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, no, I don't have a good answer for that.
Okay,
because I don't understand Graham, because I'm very different from Graham.
Except the impotence.
Yeah, the impotence and the bug eyes. I got both those.
And the black shirts.
I do wear a lot of black shirts.
And you have the same amount of hair on your head as Graham does.
Yeah. To people that have never met me, my hair is exactly the same.
That blonde, that parted, and that flowing. Have you thought about the plants in this movie?
Not particularly. I mean, I've thought about them in that, you know, the big part of one scene and then a small part of a following scene, one specific plant. But I haven't thought about it.
Okay, so I assume you mean John putting that potted plant on his dick?
Yes, and then Anne walking by that plant when she visits her sister.
Right, and you remember a plant near the end of the movie too.
Remind me?
Cynthia's birthday present from...
Oh, yes, of course.
Anne?
Yep.
I just didn't know. Sometimes get upset with the visual metaphors. I didn't know if this was one that stood out to you or bothered you.
I mean, there have been so many by that point.
Oh, what else?
Well, I mentioned
shirt, the black hat,
and the way that that's framed, the black shirt and the lawyer in the white suit. There's a very that whole minimalist versus maximalist conversation that goes on where he's like, "I've got one key." I'm like, "No, lock your door when you go to bed." Also, and
we get it. You're a hippie. Yeah. Lock fucking door and go to sleep. Yeah.
I don't have a job either, but I lock my door when I go to bed because I don't have a job and can't afford to replace the shit that gets stolen if I'm robbed. And yeah, that whole, you know, lawyer versus guy that really appreciates one key. Like, I bet John's got fucking 10 keys, you know? He's got a gym membership. He's probably got a locker there. He's got a car. He's probably got two cars. He's got a house. Back door might have a separate key. Might have a shed.
His car is a key. He starts it with a smaller key. I actually like the part when he gives after John's gone over to Graham's place near the end, punched him in the face, and then watched his Anne's tape.
Yes, no, that part's good. That's like the high point of the movie to me.
Yeah, no, I like the part where he gives him his keys back, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah, just drops them on.
Yeah, that's a nice little thing of like, you know, here are your problems. Like, you've kind of fucked with my life a lot. You've lived this way for 9 years to pretend like you don't have any problems, but you know, here you go.
Yeah, for sure.
Again. A little over the top for other parts of the movie, perhaps, but I thought that was a nice little bit there.
Yep.
I assume you like the part where we go from this TV screen showing Anne's interview to kind of the real footage of Anne's interview.
Yep, I do like that whole the way we go from Anne's interview back to Anne's home. Just all of the time shifting that happens. In that period of the movie, I like.
Yes. Right. Okay. Yeah. We talked about Graham forcing others to reveal themselves on tape, mm-hmm. and you know him having some things maybe he does or doesn't want to talk about as well. Can we talk about Graham, the filmmaker?
Sure.
Okay. You know, we talked about this movie and its role in, you know, kind of film history about it being a really big milestone for independent cinema.
Yeah.
So to think of it in kind of that context, does Steven Soderbergh see himself as Graham a little bit, or what's the kind of filmmaker making a movie about making film angle you want to take on this one that you love to discuss so much?
Well, I like to discuss Soderbergh. I don't necessarily not all aspects of filmmaker making a film about filming, but this movie, when it came out, Soderbergh talked about how the four characters were different aspects of his personality. In the years following, he said that was bullshit. So, and that really sums up how Soderbergh approaches talking in public. He doesn't care about truth always. And he's also always been very entertaining and very funny. But as somebody that has read published versions of his diaries, I can really actually see parts of him in a lot of different places. Like, the idea of, even if we just look at his career, the idea of doing something instead of focusing on yourself. I mean, Soderbergh is very much a workaholic, probably the most prominent, workaholic in Hollywood until like a year and a half ago. As far as filmmakers go,
who do you lose the belt to?
He just kind of, I don't know. I think, well, now that he's doing the Nick and directing all 10 episodes, maybe he's got it back, but.
I was looking over his career. It's hard to find a place where there's even a 1 year gap of him releasing feature length movies.
Yeah.
And then usually that year, two things come out. Like, yeah. And yeah, that's been from 1989. He's been releasing pretty much something, releasing something pretty much every year.
Yeah, he just likes working. And I mean, he's also very self-deprecating in conversation and in those aforementioned diaries. And he does joke about his inability to want to actually focus on himself. And I think that's kind of why you don't get a strong auteur voice with Steven Soderbergh's career. I think if there is a voice, it's the voice of like a very nomadic voice. Like there are little things that that stay from movie to movie, but there's no one thing keeping everything together throughout his whole career. And yeah, well,
the one thing that I see is kind of a thread through not everything. I haven't seen everything, but a big common theme is lying.
Oh, definitely. Well, yes, for sure. He does like to play with the truth, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, in some of the, you know, I was reading about some of the projects where you're not sure whether they're improvising or whether they're playing themselves or exaggerated versions of themselves, but yeah. Graham,
Bubble is a really good example of that.
Well, it was Bubble I was reading about. You know, Graham describes himself as a pathological liar, and lies, you know, we assume he's lying throughout this movie, but says he's been telling a lot of lies for the past 9 years. And I guess Soderbergh's biggest thing would be the Ocean's trilogy, which is about a bunch of con artists.
Yeah, for sure.
People lying.
Well, and that whole second movie is just a big con for him to make a tribute to all of his favorite French New Wave movies in the guise of a $100 million movie.
Right. Yeah. It's just really funny to me that you bring up that, he doesn't want to talk about himself, and, one of the kind of trademarks of his career is people who aren't honest about who they are.
Yeah.
That's really interesting to me, but continue. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, I could continue talking about Soderbergh forever, but, he's kind of like the Patton Oswalt of filmmakers to me. Like I find him so interesting, but I don't always enjoy his work. Like I think he's really good at talking in public, but not necessarily always at the job that is supposed to actually be his career. You know, like I find Patton Oswalt to be a much more interesting media critic than comedian most of the time. And I find the same thing about Steven Soderbergh as a critic, as just an interesting person in conversation. And I think you just get a lot of that ability to be jumping around and being interesting in various ways in Sex, Lies, and Videotape. But yeah, I'm not even talking about the filmmaking in Sex, Lies, and Videotape. But I don't know. I think it just goes back to that whole keeping things at arm's length. Like in the commentary for this film, which is one of his commentaries where he just invites somebody to come and talk about his movie with him.
I was reading about this.
Yeah. It's a discussion with Neil LaBute.
I haven't listened to it, but what I read about it, it's just a lot of tangents about like demystifying the process of filmmaking. Yeah. And you know, talking about directing different actors and not necessarily this movie, but just you know, if you're talking about someone who jumps all over the place, like he can't even talk about the movie he's directing the commentary, recording the commentary for, you know?
Yeah, and he's recording it, I think, just as he's about to make Out of Sight. And he, by that point, I mean, he said when he looks back at the movie, he sees it as a very, he's not crazy about it now. Like, I can imagine any director like 10 years after making the film not really being that excited to actually talk about making the film, just because I think you spend so much time thinking about these things that you just want to never see them again by the time they're over. And these conversations are always interesting. My favorite one is his commentary track for The Limey is goddamn amazing, because it's him and the screenwriter Lem Dobbs, who he'd worked with before and worked with after. The Limey was shot as a very straightforward kind of thriller, revenge thriller. And have you seen it?
No, I didn't. Okay. Actually, I know the movie, but
it's very good. It's very interesting and very Soderbergian, but he basically just recut the whole thing in editing, and the whole commentary track is the Lem Dobbs and Steven Soderbergh arguing about all of the decisions that were made, because Lem Dobbs is legitimately pissed off about it and doesn't bite his tongue, and Soderbergh just responds in exactly the way you would expect him to, and it's just, it's really fascinating. Basically, any Steven Soderbergh commentary track is interesting because he never talks about the movie; he just talks about interesting things. But I do think the actual videotaping in Sex, Lies, and Videotape is very much that sort of distancing yourself thing again.
Right, and we see the part where the camera gets turned on Graham and he hates it.
Yeah, well, that's one thing I really like about this movie, because I feel like at the time him saying. He says, well, I just don't find the turning the tables thing very interesting. Like that was probably something that was very modern in 1989, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's a good bit. And when we talk about, like, I think it's just a good part of the movie, but when we talk about this in relation to Soderbergh and all the things you've said about how much he jumps around and how, kind of little of himself he reveals, you know, I totally see Graham.
Yeah.
And another thing about him jumping all over the place, because you said, I forget what it was, but you said it was very Soderbergian or something. And I don't know what that is, you know, and I haven't seen all his movies, but
I haven't seen all of his movies. It's hard to keep up, man.
Right. But I just feel like he's so scattered, and I don't mean that in a negative way. You know, maybe versatile or something's a better word. But like, I was just reading about what he's done. You know, he's done adaptations. He's done things he's written. He's directed stuff he wrote, directed stuff, you know, kind of documentary stuff.
Yeah, he did a lot of rewriting in the 90s as well.
Like exactly. He's done a lot of producing, obviously. He edits. He does his own. Like, he's his own director of photography sometime.
Yeah.
You know, he's done.
Oh, I think pretty much exclusively since Traffic, he's been his own DOP.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, like thrillers, kind of horror movies. Contagion. I don't know what you want to call that, but you know, The Informant. His Moneyball thing that almost got off the ground, which I wouldn't even know what to call that. He's done so many genres, he does so many roles. To call something Soderbergian, I don't know what that means at all.
And he has acted as well in the 90s.
Yeah, that's true. What is it about anything that makes it Soderbergian? He just seems so all over the place, it'd be impossible to pin that down.
This is part of the reason why I find him so interesting, is because it's exactly right, you can't pin him down. And the thing that I think really shows that he is a really great filmmaker, and I think he's a very like self-conscious person. He's very aware of his skills. I think he's you know, he knows he's a smart person, and he knows he's also very self-conscious. And he just always wants to do what interests him at the time. And it might be just like this little shot in like A Hard Day's Night that he wants to see if he can pull off in Ocean's 13, you know? And I think he's a very impulsive person. And if he can figure out a way to, you know, build a movie around this one section that he wants to make, he will. And I think that's something that runs through a lot of his movies, is that the movies aren't always good, but there's always something in there that's really great. Like, did you see Haywire? I can't remember.
No.
Okay. Lem Dobbs wrote that movie as well, actually. That was
I saw Hey Arnold.
Oh, okay.
That's similar.
Actually, I don't think I saw the Hey Arnold movie. So I wouldn't know. But anyways, it's just a very standard action movie, and it's fine. But there's one sequence that just all of a sudden is just shot in black and white and entirely handheld when the rest of the film really isn't. And it just looks like A Hard Day's Night, basically. And it comes out of nowhere. It's one sequence, and then it goes away and never comes back. And it's just that type of thing. Like, he just doesn't care. And I find that interesting. And as long as he can keep his budget to a certain level, he can do anything. And I think the thing that he's certainly very talented as a filmmaker, he can make cohesive films that sort of tie together his more free-flowing instincts. Like, I think, you know, when everybody talks about his career, it's pretty hard not to talk about like Traffic and Aaron Brockovich and Ocean's 11 being released. And The Limey came out right around that time as well. In such a quick period of time, The Limey has so much, is so just disjointed in how it's edited. Traffic is the first movie where he was his own DOP because he just wanted to remove things between him and being creative. Like, he just wanted to be able to be like, hey, Michael Douglas, go ruffle through those files, you know. And but then there's also like the world of Ocean's 11, which is just a very set up, like there's so much money, everything, all of these stars, like you have to make this movie in a very old-fashioned way. Like, you've just got to keep things moving. And Ocean's 11 is a really good movie. Like front to back, I think it's just a really entertaining, one of the best examples of like modern Hollywood filmmaking. And it sort of reminded me of when we were talking about X-Men a lot. Like, I think there isn't really a discernible Steven Soderbergh element to Ocean's 11. Just like, I don't see a discernible like Bryan Singer element to his X-Men movies, but I think they're all really well directed, right? And it's just kind of like, they're hired guns, but they're like the best at being a hired gun type of director, you know? Yep. It's just like all of the decisions made are the right decision, even if they're very mainstream decisions.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I see that.
Yeah. And the thing that sets Soderbergh apart from the pack is that he'll just try anything, you know? And yeah. He made the first movie entirely shot on the Red Epic, which ended up being a super revolutionary camera for the way people make films now. But I don't know. He's very into trying new things, and often will sacrifice good versions of like old ideas to do so. Yeah.
Okay. So he's just like a total bohemian like Graham, is what you're telling me.
I don't know. He just baffles me. And this is why I'll never stop being interested in him. And I mean, like, I've followed his career basically since 2000 when Traffic was released, and I saw it and was like, oh, this is interesting. And like, by that time I care about directors, so I started following him a little bit. And I don't think I figured any more of him out since then when I was 14. But he's fascinating to think about.
Yeah.
And he will never stop being entertaining to listen to. Like, he's a legitimately funny guy as well, which is very helpful.
Yeah, have you seen how many people reviewing this film call it a comedy? Like, I was looking over some of their posters, and they say, I don't know, they kept calling it a comedy and kept saying how funny this movie was. There's like four hilarious parts in this movie, but it's not a comedy at all.
Are these like are these poster blurbs?
Yeah.
Are they from like notable people?
I couldn't see because the only images I could find of it were really grainy. Like, zoom in onto the actual quote, but it was the real poster.
That's weird. Yeah, I don't know the only explanation, because I don't find it a particularly funny movie, other than some of the, you know, the idea that I could call some of the metaphors as they're happening.
You didn't think Stephen Brill as the barfly in The Bayou was funny?
I didn't think he was particularly funny.
Oh,
like, I thought the fact that it was Stephen Brill was funny to me.
I think the second time he tries our shirts are the same color line.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's kind of funny.
Oh, man, I was so happy about that. Yeah, anyway, one more real point about Graham as Soderbergh.
Did we go on a tangent? Did we go on a Soderbergh-like tangent there?
Yeah, we did.
Sorry, when I said we, I meant me.
No, this is actually completely a little bit to your point. It's just we have a filmmaker in this movie,
mm-hmm.
in Graham. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if it would bug you or not, but he's so much of the artistic person's dream.
Yeah,
like he's like dark but charming, and he's creative and has endless money, and that comes from nowhere apparently. And at one point, a character says to him, "You've had an effect on my life." Is this just not what every artist or director, or at least Soderbergh, wants to be and wants to hear?
Maybe at this point, I honestly think Soderbergh from like 2003 on works just because he liked working. I really think he's so self-centered that he does not care about anybody's opinions of his movies.
Okay.
And also, I mean, by that point, he's got an Oscar. So, I mean, what else can you do, right? But, yeah, at this point, he might be kind of idealizing it. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't have a lot of thoughts about it, I suppose.
Yeah, it just... I don't know, because I was thinking about, obviously, Soderbergh, and just, you know, we have a filmmaker in this movie. It just seemed easy to kind of put him in that position, especially writing and directing this movie. And... you know, kind of a very, very obvious criticism of yuppie culture throughout this movie.
Yeah.
You know, when Anne gets asked about what she likes about John and what she likes about marriage, it's, you know, oh, we have a house and he has a secure job. And then in the end, she finds happiness with the, you know, artsy minimalist guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah, I can hear you rolling your yeah, I just didn't know if that was like Soderbergh's, you know, art will save us all kind of thing.
I don't, because yeah, maybe at the time,
yeah, maybe in 89, yeah,
because he's 26 I think when he makes this movie,
and 26 year olds are assholes.
I said that about myself as a 26-year-old. I still think 28-year-olds are assholes. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Because there's so much less... like, Steven Soderbergh was much less documented at this time. You know, so it's harder to get a feel for it. But
We never really got back to talking about the legacy of this movie.
Okay. Well, allow me to try and do so in the most succinct way possible. This movie is very successful, and it sort of gives these sort of specialty arms like Miramax. It gave Miramax a lot of money to try to make the next version of Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And so they start buying more scripts. They start distributing more, taking more chances with actual narrative film, where most of the 80s had been just them banking on the foreign audience. The small foreign audience, so they could pay. They knew what they could pay for a foreign movie, and they knew what they had to market for it. And also concert films, and you know, they start buying more scripts. They end up with Reservoir Dogs, distributing that. That didn't set the world on fire in box office. I don't think it did particularly well at all, but it kept them with Quentin Tarantino. And when the script for Pulp Fiction went in turnaround, they snapped it up and they made Pulp Fiction. And Sex, Lies, and Videotape is kind of like Jaws, and Pulp Fiction is Star Wars. Sex, Lies, and Videotape is still where, you know, you don't totally know what you're doing and you're just kind of feeling your way through the thing. And then the next thing is the really, really huge, unstoppable success, you know, like, and
you kind of uncover the market and then really exploit it properly. Yeah, exactly. The next time around,
Pulp Fiction was the first independent movie to open on over 1,000 screens simultaneously. And in the 90s, 1,000 screens is a much bigger deal than it is now. But for independent, that was pretty crazy. They opened an independent film like it was a major studio film, and it worked. Like, it made over $100 million and was a cultural sensation. And I mean, we talked about this in our Quentin Tarantino podcast. It was definitely the most American, or the most influential American film. I think I don't think anything more influential has been made since. We talked about, when we look back, the most influential film since then will have been The Dark Knight, probably. But Pulp Fiction just totally changed the game in independent cinema. And then, everything Hollywood and independent became closer together, because you had these stars, slumming it, quote unquote, slumming it in this low budget movie because to be interesting. Like, John Travolta was very much in movie jail. He was in Look Who's Talking, and he goes into Quentin Tarantino movie. He becomes interesting. So you start getting these movies. Good Will Hunting is a good example, because they built their movie around, they had a mantra. Damon and Affleck had a mantra when they were writing that movie. It was Stallone and Keitel. They knew that Stallone had written written Rocky and wouldn't let himself be kicked off the cast list. So they were like, we're still going to be in this movie. We're writing it for ourselves. And Keitel, because Reservoir Dogs got made because Harvey Keitel found the script interesting. So they're like, we need our Keitel. So whatever Robin Williams' role in that movie is, they wrote that as like a movie star part. They gave him all the best lines. And they were like, well, if Morgan Freeman wants the role, we'll just adjust it to Morgan Freeman and all this stuff. And that was made by Miramax because they had money from Pulp Fiction. And that sort of... And then the Boondock Saints is another good tangent for Pulp Fiction, is that it inspired all of these bullshit Tarantino copycats. And finally, the not horrible tier, like the Boondock Saints tier and the Good Will Hunting tier, horrible garbage. And then we've got the good tier, where we get Paul Thomas Anderson, Spike Jonze, Charlie Kaufman, David Fincher. David Fincher had a career by that point, but very highly positively impacted by Pulp Fiction's success. Steven Soderbergh's rebirth in the late 90s very much owes to Pulp Fiction. Wes Anderson. These studios started taking, because of Tarantino, started taking chances on more interesting auteurs that were willing to try stuff like make a movie about porn in the 70s. Yeah.
When's our Boondock Saints podcast? Oh, God.
I want to do a podcast about the movie about the making of the Boondock Saints. Have you seen this movie? It's called Overnight. It's
no.
A documentary about Troy Duffy from the day he signs the deal to his deal for the script for the Boondock Saints until like 5 years later. It's crazy. You would love it. It's bananas. Yeah. He's an asshole.
That sounds super interesting.
Oh, man. It's so great. I will send you a link. Everybody watch Overnight. Just do it. I watched it again last week and was like, this movie's still amazing.
Because apparently we're podcasting about it.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I feel like that's pretty succinct. And
that was pretty good, actually.
As much as it can be. I will say I have been thinking a lot about 90s filmmaking recently. But
you're going at Busta Rhymes' pace, too. That helps.
Because I knew people would get bored. Soderbergh and I have that in common. We're always trying to edit things down into the shortest possible version. But yeah, and I think that all of that really comes to a head. And I don't want to rehash this argument, but with American Beauty in 1999, where you get the extremely commercially successful studio version of all of those things together in one film. Yeah,
and it sucks dick.
Cool at Jonah Hill.
No, I meant the legacy of Sex, Lies, and Videotape in how many TV shows have named an episode kind of like Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Well, it does have a good title. Like, and I mean, Soderbergh has said, and I'm sure Harvey Weinstein would say the same thing, is that the fact that sex is in the name of this movie is so important.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, well, it's interesting because sex, obviously... I mean, sex sells. I'm not the first person to say that, I don't think.
No, I think I think the phrase is videotape sells.
Videotape sells. Sex, lies, which, you know, as we talked about, is a big part of this movie and a big part of Soderbergh's career. And then videotape, it really kind of places it in this historical context. Like, we're moving more towards... all the things we've been talking about independent film, but also the home video market's really kind of exploding around this time too.
Yeah, for sure. And Soderbergh on that commentary track I mentioned talks about how, you know, he wasn't always immediately going to use videotape. He just sort of felt that the video camera was on the verge of becoming like a thing, you know, and it could have been still photography or something like in a very early stage. And he just sort of felt like the video camera was a really burgeoning market.
Yeah. And I understand that name, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, was not, you know, he apparently submitted a bunch of offers of the title to producers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of went back and forth about it, and that's what they ended up with.
Yeah, I believe the one he preferred was like 49:20 or something, and it's the
length. No, you're thinking 4:20. No, it's 42:06, I think.
42:06, okay, yeah, and the idea was it was the length of Anne's tape.
Yeah.
Which is, come on.
But that does have 420 in it.
You got a colon in there too, though.
No, but it was kind of a, you know, as you said, it wasn't breaking records, but it was kind of a cultural moment, even at the time, even if we don't take it in that context. And it's a catchy title, and it's, you know, essentially it's X, Y, and Z. So it's really not hard to appropriate it to whatever you want, which is why X-Men the Animated Series has an episode called Weapon X Lies in Videotape.
Well, and yeah, and I mean, just for marketing, the title itself sounds like a tagline. So,
you know. Yeah, that's true. It could be 4206 tagline, Sex Lies in Videotape. I think that's all I have.
Yeah. Okay, well, you can go, and I'm going to talk about Steven Soderbergh for another 4 minutes. Did I say 4 minutes? I meant hours.
The poster boy of the Sundance Generation, according to Roger Ebert?
Yeah, I mean, he was for a bit, but have you ever read about his relationship with Robert Redford?
No, I'm guessing a lot of beef.
Well, I mean, Robert Redford's the most passive-aggressive asshole.
Listen to our...
Winter Soldier, was it Captain 2? Did we talk about it there?
Yeah, oh, it did come up then. I think the article you wrote and... Why am I forgetting the name of this movie? Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, The President's Men, you jackass!
Oh, there it is.
Sorry, I just went Ben Bradley on you for a second.
And I apologize like halfway through that.
It's not good enough. Forgetting the name of All the President's Men is unforgivable. Anyways, the...
Condor.
So Sex, Lies, and Videotape made a big splash at Sundance, kind of legitimized the festival, and Soderbergh was invited back the next year. He was a big part of the jury, I believe, and eventually I believe it was King of the Hill where that Redford,
the movie, not the TV show,
yeah exactly, that Redford wanted to produce. And there was just a lot of back and forth, and Redford loves making people, like, he's like Lorne Michaels in that he loves making people wait for meetings for like 3 hours just because he's doing other shit on his ranch or whatever. And
or he's not doing other shit and just likes the idea of people waiting on him.
Redford's the worst. And there was just a lot of fragmentation there. And he was, there was also a period where during that time where Redford was filming Havana, a movie he's the star of, and Steven Soderbergh's then wife, whose name I'm forgetting, was in the cast of that movie.
Betsy Brantley?
Yes, that sounds right. Yep. And she was in the cast of that movie, and Robert Redford would come up to her on the set and say, "Tell your husband to call me," which she felt was Redford trying to be nice to her, but came off as such a horrible thing. That didn't help things. Anyways, eventually Soderbergh and Redford were never going to work together just because Soderbergh would tell him that, and then Redford would be like, "Well, we'll meet again in 3 weeks and you'll show me a cut," and then Redford just wouldn't show up.
Giving him the Kirkland treatment.
And he lost the client. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week. We haven't talked about what we'll be talking about yet, but yeah, I'm sure it will be a good movie. Or at least I hope it will be a good movie. Anyways, thanks for listening. Check back next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.